Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, Cautionary Goals for Your Garden This Year by Paul Capiello. Here we all go again, folks. It's a time of year we drag out the hefty bags, clean out the closets, and make well-intentioned promises to ourselves to eat less sugar, get more exercise, and generally be better and more responsible people. And at the outset, allow me to applaud our collective annual ritual of listening to those better voices and doing our level best to ignore that annoying, grumpy angel who always sits just out of view but rarely out of earshot. Kudos to us. But allow me, at the same time, to offer a cautionary note at this time of hope and an annual self-renewal. After all, we are creatures of habit, and those of us who consider ourselves any measure of gardener, well, we're in a particularly challenging predicament. You see, gardeners share many common and consistent traits. No matter your style, the level of resources you can bring to bear on any project, or the brand of baggage you carry with you to the compost pile, gardeners are a delightfully diverse lot. But we are, more than any other group of people I know, astonishingly predictable. And that is why my annual horticultural Nostradamusing is such a slam dunk. Resolution number one. I'm going to get an early start this year. Yep, this is one's at the top of my list, too. Problem is, I'm already late. After growing hellebores in my garden for 40 years, and after proselytizing about cutting back the foliage before first flowering to make the process take 5 minutes rather than 2 hours, I'm already behind the eight ball. Those first delicate blooms have already threaded themselves up between the wiry petioles, and now rather than a grab and whack, I have to do the ever so delicate snip, 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 one leaf at a time. And even at that, I'll nick a few of those precious winter blooms. It seems that no matter what we have in our grand gardener plan, there's always something that comes up. 20-plus years ago, when I started my job at Udell Botanical Gardens, people have always asked why we spend so much of our time during the early years working on the buildings rather than the gardens. And my answer was always, when there are weeds in the garden and rain is pouring through the roof of the building, even a gardener can make that calculation. My advice for resolution number one is to make it a short list, a very short list, and give yourself some grace if something gets in the way. January comes around every year. Resolution number two, I'm going to make my garden look just the way I want this year. Oh, dear garden friend, please sit down on this bench and let's have a chat. Are you really still here? Are you still desperately clinging to that notion of your garden, or any garden for that matter, being done? Or getting it to the point where you can recline in that hammock, drink in hand, look out across your pride and joy, and think to yourself, perfect? Yeah, I didn't think so. Me neither. For some reason, we all think we have the responsibility to apologize for the state of our garden at any point of the year. We seem compelled to say to any visitor, as soon as I have a chance, I'm gonna ... You fill in the blanks yourself. A garden mentor many years ago taught me a very valuable lesson. Your garden is what it is. Don't apologize for it. If your visitors don't like your particular brand of occasional weeding or edging or even watering, they'll get over it. Enjoy what you've created, whatever it is. Resolution number three. This year I'm going all organic. I'm guessing this is the one that will get me the most hate mail. So before you start typing that letter to the editor, hear this. I have nothing at all against organic gardening. Heck, I'm about 95% of the way there in my own garden. But I like so many things in life, getting 95% of the way there is usually the easy part. It's that last 5% that can lead to the need for counseling or medication. Rather than going all in, maybe a better approach is to make meaningful improvements in what you do in the garden. Maybe it's moving away from soluble fertilizers and going more in the direction of composts. How about leaving a brush pile in the back corner of the garden for the birds and the bees? This could be the year you turn off the automatic irrigation controller and just water when the garden needs it rather than every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday between 11 a.m. and noon. The key is Go easy on yourself. Improving your garden or your gardening is just like improving your diet, your exercise schedule, and your social media habits. As for me, I'm going right out into the garden to start turning my compost just as soon as I finish off that plate of leftover Christmas cookies. That column written by Paul Capiello, Executive Director of U. Dell Botanical Garden in Crestwood, Kentucky. Also from the Arizona Republic, Prep Those Garden Tools for Spring Planting by Christine Michael. Are your garden tools ready for spring? Now's the time to get them cleaned up and sharpened. Ideally, you should have done all of this when you cleaned up the garden last fall. But let's face it, there's always something else that claims your attention through the end of the year. Make good on your New Year's resolution to become better organized and place cleaning your tools at the top of the list. You can do this outside if it's a nice day, but the garage or basement are often better choices. Gather your hand tools and long-handled ones too. Clean and remove the rust. Remove all the dirt before starting this project. Don't be surprised if some of the tools are rusty. Rust will shorten the useful life of your tools, so we'll address rust removal first. You will need a 3-to-1 ratio of white vinegar and water in a bucket. Add your rusty tool and let it sit for a few hours or overnight. Wear rubber gloves to remove the tool from the vinegar mixture, rinse it off with fresh water, and dry with a shop towel. Be sure to wear gloves, otherwise your hands and fingernails will turn black. The next step is cleaning the metal. Be sure to wear protective eyeglasses because of small, uncontrolled flying metal pieces. Use a wire brush, toothbrush, or steel wool to clean the metal. You can avoid all of the manual scrubbing if you have a wire brush attachment for your drill. Sharpening your tools. The next step is sharpening. Obviously, not all tools are shaped the same. Slightly different methods may be required for each. You will need a mill file or a rasp file, whetstone, lubricant, clean towel, and safety glasses. Sharpen harvest knives, shears, and snips with the whetstone. Soak the whetstone in water before using, noting that one side has a fine grain and the other is rough. Start with the rough side. Draw the blade side at a 20-degree angle across the whetstone, always working in the same direction and moving from left to right. Do this with both sides of the blade, then repeat the steps using the whetstone's fine grain. You may need to add water to the surface of the whetstone during this process. Dry the blade and evaluate the sharpness. Larger tools need to be secured or clamped with the front side facing up. Using a file or abrasive stone, only sharpen the inside edge of a shovel because it has a single bevel. Maintaining a 45-degree angle, push the file or abrasive stone away from the edge of the blade. A farmer's file is a useful tool to sharpen hoes because it has a rough side and a fine side. Only sharpen the underside of the blade because it has a single bevel. Although there are two sides to the blades on pruning shears, you should only sharpen the beveled side. Finishing the job. Once the metal surface is clean of rust and sharpened, apply a light coat of oil to the tool. This will prevent rust in the future. Any type of oil is acceptable. You should coat the wooden handles on tools with linseed oil to prevent them from drying out and extend their life. Store your tools in a dry location, making sure the blade tips are not touching the floor. This year, be sure to remove caked on soil and plant debris from your tools after each use. Not only will this prevent the transfer of soil-borne diseases, but it will also reduce the risk of rust. Here's another column that appeared recently in the Arizona Republic. Help save the monarch butterfly from disappearing, by Kim Frisbee. We have just learned that the iconic monarch butterfly may be placed on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's endangered species list. The significant decline in the numbers of this beloved species, renowned for migrating thousands of miles across North America, is due to habitat loss and the widespread use of pesticides and herbicides throughout its natural range. The monarch's fascinating lifestyle is studied by children of all ages. Its metamorphosis from caterpillar to butterfly for three successive generations culminates in a fourth and final migratory generation, which flies up to 3,000 miles to an exact location pinpointed by an incredible internal radar system. This remarkable multi-generational migration is a marvel of the natural world. the eastern migratory butterfly has declined by 85%, while the western population has lost 98% of its numbers, putting it a greater than 99% chance of extinction if nothing is done on its behalf. We cannot continue to destroy insect pollinator habitat through excess pesticide and herbicide use in our farmlands, grasslands, wetlands, and forests. Economic prosperity and ecological health must be codependent. Working lands that provide food and energy essential to human survival must also maintain the essential habitat needed by all wildlife species, including insect pollinators, birds, and butterflies. Productive, healthy farming and pollinator conservation must coexist, and this is the goal of all organic agriculture. Monarchs are a keystone species, epitomizing strength, resiliency, grace, and beauty. We can all participate in conservation efforts to restore and protect their habitat. Most of you know that monarchs depend on milkweed for their survival, as this host plant is the only one on which caterpillars can feed. But unfortunately, just planting more milkweed is not the answer to the existing problem. The tropical milkweed, which is so often promoted by nurseries, contains the bacterium OE, which is fatal to monarchs. If you already have tropical milkweed in your garden, cut it all the way back to the ground after caterpillars have eaten the foliage. This will minimize the risk of infection by the OE bacterium. Numerous conservation organizations across the U.S. are working to save the monarchs, and you can be a part of this critical effort. If you have an environmental company that regularly treats your property with pesticides, you might reconsider the ramifications to the monarch's habitat. One exceptional conservation movement close to home here in Florida is Community Greening, CG, a nonprofit urban forestry initiative started in Delray Beach in 2016. CG promotes the concept of tree equity, whereby every city neighborhood has enough trees to benefit the people living there. Its mission is to improve the urban environment through the planting of trees. Numerous studies have shown what we already know but largely take for granted. Trees in cities provide climate resiliency, health benefits, and employment opportunities to which everyone should be entitled. Shade trees cool neighborhoods, reducing heat-related illnesses and utility costs. They trap air pollutants, sequester carbon, produce oxygen, and provide critical habitat and infrastructure essential to our quality of life. Urban areas without trees experience daytime temperatures 5 to 15 degrees higher and nighttime temps 2.5 degrees higher than outlying areas with more tree canopy. Wealthier areas usually have more trees and enjoy the associated benefits. Let's all work together to restore habitat for the monarch, which means no more pesticides on your landscapes. Happy New Year to all. Now here's a column from USA Today. Cabbage is one of the most nutrient-dense vegetables around. Here's why, by Daryl Austin. Few foods are thought to be more synonymous with health than garden salads. Though often only praised for nutritious toppings and ingredients such as tomatoes, cucumbers, avocado, chopped onions, hard-boiled eggs, and greens like iceberg or romaine, garden salads can also have plenty of problematic ingredients. Croutons, bacon bits, ground beef, too much cheese, and creamy salad dressing can all be worrisome. Such ingredients are why one report shows some salads having more calories than a burger. To make salads healthier, vinaigrettes are often substituted for creamy dressing. Nuts, seeds, and roasted chickpeas are substituted for croutons. Grilled chicken replaces ground beef and bacon. And greens, like iceberg, are replaced with more nutrient-dense ones like kale and spinach. Cabbage is another healthier substitute for some salad greens and is an ingredient in other sides and dishes that are continually growing in popularity. So what is cabbage? Belonging to the same cruciferous vegetable family as cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli, cabbage is a leafy plant known for its dense leaves, earthy flavor, and satisfying crunch. While popular in garden salads, cabbage is also a key ingredient in dishes like coleslaw, sauerkraut, stir-fries, stuffed cabbage rolls, and hearty soups like borscht, says Carolyn Susi, a registered dietitian and national spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Indeed, Gabbage's versatility and delicious flavor in recipes is virtually unmatched, adds Catherine Talmadge, a nutrition author and registered dietitian at Personalized Nutrition. The vegetable can be sweet, savory, spicy, salty, sour, and is eaten in every culture known to man, she says. There are more than 400 varieties of cabbage, but green cabbage, red, purple cabbage, and Napa cabbage, also known as Chinese cabbage, are the most popular. Bok choy is another type of cabbage that people love, though it's different in appearance from red or green cabbage, as it doesn't have a round head with a tight, overlapping leaves, but instead has loose, separate leaves with thick, white stalks. China is by far the world's largest producer of cabbage, followed by India, Russia, Japan, and then South Korea, per World Atlas. So is cabbage good for you? Well, no matter where the cabbage you eat comes from, the vegetable packs a host of health benefits. A single serving of raw green cabbage, for instance, contains protein, calcium, folate, magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, vitamin C, and vitamin K, per the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Cabbage is also high in insoluble fiber, which aids with blood sugar regulation and helps with digestion regularity, says Leslie Bonsi, a sports dietitian for the Kansas City Chiefs and founder of Active Eating Advice. Bonsi adds that cruciferous vegetables like cabbage can also decrease your risk of colon cancer due to the presence of glucosinolates and other plant chemicals, including isothiocyanates and sulforaphane. Sulforaphane is especially important because it modulates genetic and non-genetic mechanisms that are effective at preventing genetic and non-genetic cancer-inducing mechanisms in the liver, breast, lung, and colon, explains Talmadge. She adds that the vegetable also contains important phytonutrients such as anthocyanin, which can lower risk of heart disease and neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Cabbage is low in calories, only about 200 in a small or medium head, which, combined with its satiety due to its high fiber content, make it a great food for healthy weight management. Can you eat cabbage every day? Despite so many health benefits, some people may want to consume cabbage in moderation. It can cause bloating or gas in some people due to its fiber and natural sulfur compounds, cautioned Susie. But she adds that cooking it can help reduce its gas-forming properties and make it easier to digest. Moreover, people on blood-thinning medication should be mindful of cabbage's high vitamin K content, which can affect clotting, Susie says. So long as such considerations are kept in mind, though, she says cabbage is a great food to include as part of a healthy diet because cabbage has an impressive nutrition profile, is rich in vitamins and antioxidants, and supports digestion and overall health. From the Arizona Republic, the Desert Botanical Garden is turning 86, How the Papago Park Preserve Came to Be, by Marcus Reichley. The Desert Botanical Garden, an oasis nestled among the red rocks of Papago Park, turns 86 in February. The idea for a desert garden came from a small group of valley-based advocates in the 1930s. Botanist Gustav Stark rallied those passionate about preserving desert plant life with a giant sign outside his Scottsdale ranch. "Save the desert," it said. The Stark Ranch was located on a pie-shaped wedge of land between the corner of Scottsdale and Indian School Roads and the Arizona Canal, according to a 1985 article by Elizabeth Fritz for Agave, the Desert Botanical Gardens quarterly magazine at the time. The ranch's location today is home to the Fifth Avenue Shopping District in the heart of Scottsdale. Stark collected a showcase of cactuses and succulents on his ranch, which soon earned him a reputation among his fellow desert flora lovers. In many ways, he was the father of a movement that would bring a botanical garden to Phoenix, one that would be unique in its specialization. Concerned about the rapid urbanization of the valley and the general underappreciation of desert plant life, Stark and his peers formed the Arizona Cactus and Native Flora Society on April 18, 1934. In May of 1936, philanthropist Gertrude Webster of Vermont was elected president of the society. She had inherited a large fortune from a family lumber business and joined the society at the invitation of Stark, who retained an influential role even after Webster assumed leadership. On January 2, 1937, the Arizona Cactus and Native Flora Society became a nonprofit corporation. Webster began hosting events open to the public at her Camelback Mountain estate, where guests heard speeches in favor of a botanical garden in Phoenix. Representatives from Boyce Thompson Arboretum in Superior, the Carnegie Desert Laboratory in Tucson, and the University of Arizona Botany Department all spoke at these events to support the Arizona Cactus and Native Flora Society's mission. Owners of the Arizona Republic and the Phoenix Gazette were named to the advisory board. An Arizona Republic story from February 16, 1937, opened with the newly announced slogan of the Cactus Society, not to destroy nature, but to glorify her. It was reported that a few days earlier, Webster and her group had made it clear that Papago Park was the ideal location for a botanical garden. Just under 2 years later, on February 12, 1939, a piece of land for Papago Park would be formally dedicated to the Desert Botanical Garden. Work on the garden had already begun before the ceremony, however. Webster's work was key to shaping the garden. It was reported that she helped design the layout of the garden as well as find funding. Of the $40,000 raised at the time, Webster donated one-fourth of that from her own funds, according to Agave. Quite different will be the Phoenix Botanical Garden in Papago Park once it's completed, read a December 1939 letter to the Republic from Stark. At this point, construction of the park was in full swing, with donations of succulents and cacti coming in from public and private donors all over the state. Here, the cactus botany, which is comparatively new and which, according to scientists, is still in its infancy, can and will be studied by scientists from all over the world, because a botanical garden in Papago Park will be the only one of its kind in the world, Stark's letter read. Stark died just a few years later. The Arizona Republic posted his obituary on July 9, 1945, where it was reported that he had passed away overnight from a heart attack at 74. The Swedish-born founder of the Cactus Society was buried at Greenwood Memory Lawn Cemetery in Phoenix. Gertrude Webster, who oversaw the creation of the Desert Botanical Garden as the Society's president, died 2 years later, on March 31, 1947. The Desert Botanical Garden covers 140 acres and features over 50,000 plant displays. It also boasts almost 100,000 dried herbarium specimens and over 4,000 living species, including more than 500 rare and endangered species. Today, over 500,000 visitors annually visit the Desert Botanical Garden to learn about and see stunning examples of life that flourish in one of the harshest climates. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called A Veteran's Garden. It was written by James P. Glazer. And there's a quote here from Dr. Joyce Brothers. The best proof of love is trust. A Veteran's Garden. My uncle was with the 8th Air Force in World War II. After the war, he got into growing gladiolus. My dad was a Marine in Korea. When he got out, fruit trees were his thing. I was a Marine in Vietnam from 1968 to 1969. When I came home, it took me years to realize what plants can do for you. I never could talk about the war, neither could Dad or Uncle Louie, but I was worse. I couldn't talk about anything. My wife said over and over, "You never say anything." I couldn't. I didn't know how. I lost that skill in Vietnam. I don't know how or why I lost it. I had it when I got there, but it was gone when I came back. I just stuffed things inside and let them eat at me. A lot of the Vietnam vets I know have a problem getting close to people. When you're in combat, you form fierce bonds with your squad members. You get closer than you were with your own brothers. After a few of these people get killed, the loss is so great you're afraid to get close to other people. You love your wife and children, but you're so afraid you might lose them, you can't express it. At the same time, you get protective, very protective, maybe controlling at times. You can't relax and be normal. That's how I was, wound up, tight, silent, a mess. And then one day I heard my dad talking to his apple trees. Well, I want you to know it is very impolite to listen to a man talking to his plants. So I didn't. But it got me to thinking. I started my garden the very next day. The first year I didn't talk to my plants like my dad. I yelled at them. How can you be so dumb? I'd shout at the tomatoes. What's wrong with you? I'd rant at the sunflowers. Lighten up, would you? It's over, okay? Who do you think you are? I was like a drill instructor swearing at his recruits. Only when I was yelling at the plants, I was really yelling at myself. Those days of yelling at my poor plants let me sort out the things that were bottled up in me. Sometimes I watered my plants with tears. Going to war isn't nice. It's a time where on one hand you're a god, and on the other hand you're a scared high school kid. And then when I got back from Nam, some people spat on me and called me a baby killer. I was so mad and so frustrated, so empty inside, I didn't know what to do. So I yelled at my plants. It's hard for a combat vet to ask for help, but my plants gave it to me. My garden became my community. I cared for my plants. I brought them things like water and compost. I protected them from weeds and insects. I read about gardening and learned how you could plant flowers to attract good insects that would help with the bad ones. And they responded. And they grew wonderfully. After that first season, I got so I could talk to my plants. I could even sing to them, stuff like show tunes and the Marine Corps hymn. I would say things like, "How's it going? You need anything? You look good today." I learned patience from plants. You can't hurry a carrot. I got to feel pride again. I have the best early girl tomato you ever tasted, and I wanted to talk to people again, to tell them about my garden and share my harvest. And then I started to think about communicating my inner feelings with my three children. By this time, my wife was gone, and I deeply wanted a real relationship with my kids, one where we could talk about life and ideas and feelings, not just school and the weather. So I practiced with my plants. "I want you to know how important you are to me," I'd say. "I'm trying. Sometimes I get so mad I just want to shout, and I don't know why. I want you to read this book. I think it would explain how I feel about this." That made all the difference in the world. Today I am friends with all my children. We can talk in an equal person-to-person way. My oldest, Nikki, is an adult now. We talk each week. She and I can talk about anything. Garrett, my son, will finish college this spring. We are good friends. Whitney, my baby, just got back from a 10-city concert tour with her college singing group. She called on her first day back to tell me all about it. After I was able to connect with my children, I met Charmaine, the woman I want to spend the rest of my life with. And the garden was right there waiting for me when I wanted to practice what I would say to her. I'm proud now to be a Vietnam vet. I wasn't a baby killer. I was a guy like my dad or Uncle Louie who got his country's call and answered it. And I can talk to people now. I've learned that people are just like plants. You treat them nice, and they will do the same for you. The Marines sent me overseas, but it took gardening to bring me home. That's called A Veteran's Garden, written by James P. Glazer, one of the many stories that make up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.